Random House Audio presents As I Lay Dying by William Faulkner. Read for you by Mark Cashman, Robertson Dean, Lena Patel, and Lorna Raver. Darl. Jewel and I come up from the field, following the path in single file. Although I am 15 feet ahead of him, anyone watching us from the cotton house can see Jewel's frayed and broken straw hat a full head above my own. The path runs straight as a plumb line, worn smooth by feet and baked brick-hard by July, between the green rows of laid-by cotton to the cotton house in the center of the field, where it turns and circles the cotton house at 4 soft right angles and goes on across the field again, worn so by feet in fading precision. The cotton house is of rough logs, from between which the chinking has long fallen. Square, with a broken roof set at a single pitch, it leans, in empty and shimmering dilapidation, in the sunlight, a single broad window in 2 opposite walls, giving onto the approaches of the path. When we reach it, I turn and follow the path which circles the house. Jewel, 15 feet behind me, looking straight ahead, steps in a single stride through the window. Still staring straight ahead, his pale eyes like wood set into his wooden face, he crosses the floor in 4 strides, with the rigid gravity of a cigar store Indian dressed in patched overalls and endued with life from the hips down, and steps in a single stride through the opposite window and into the path again just as I come around the corner. In single file and 5 feet apart, and Jewel now in front, we go on up the path toward the foot of the bluff. Tull's wagon stands beside the spring, hitched to the rail, the reins wrapped about the seat stanchion. In the wagon bed are 2 chairs. Jewel stops at the spring and takes the gourd from the willow branch and drinks. I pass him and mount the path, beginning to hear Cash's saw. When I reach the top, he has quit sawing. Standing in a litter of chips, he is fitting 2 of the boards together. Between the shadow spaces, they are yellow as gold, like soft gold, bearing on their flanks in smooth undulations the marks of the adz blade. A good carpenter, Cash is. He holds the 2 planks on the trestle, fitted along the edges, in a quarter of the finished box. He kneels and squints along the edge of them. Then he lowers them and takes up the adz. A good carpenter. Addie Bundren could not want a better one, a better box to lie in. It will give her confidence and comfort. I go on to the house, followed by the chuck, chuck, chuck of the adz.
Cora. So I saved out the eggs and baked yesterday. The cakes turned out right well. We depend a lot on our chickens. They are good layers, what few we have left after the possums and such. Snakes, too, in the summer. A snake will break up a hen house quicker than anything. So after they were going to cost so much more than Mr. Tull thought, and after I promised that the difference in the number of eggs would make it up, I had to be more careful than ever, because it was on my final say-so we took them. We could have stocked cheaper chickens, but I gave my promise, as Miss Longington said when she advised me to get a good breed, because Mr. Tull himself admits that a good breed of cows or hogs pays in the long run. So when we lost so many of them we couldn't afford to use the eggs ourselves, because I could not have had Mr. Tull chide me when it was on my say-so we took them. So when Miss Longington told me about the cakes, I thought that I could bake them and earn enough at one time to increase the net value of the flock the equivalent of 2 head. And that by saving the eggs out 1 at a time, even the eggs wouldn't be costing anything. And that week they laid so well that I not only saved out enough eggs above what we had engaged to sell to bake the cakes with, I had saved enough so that the flour and the sugar and the stove wood would not be costing anything. So I baked yesterday, more careful than ever I baked in my life, and the cakes turned out right well. But when we got to town this morning, Miss Longton told me the lady had changed her mind and was not going to have the party after all. She ought to have taken those cakes anyway, Kate says. Well, I say, I reckon she never had no use for them now. She ought to have taken them, Kate says. But those rich town ladies can change their minds. Poor folks can't. Riches is nothing in the face of the Lord, for he can see into the heart. Maybe I can sell them at the bazaar Saturday, I say. They turned out real well. You can't get $2 apiece for 'em, Kate says. Well, it isn't like they cost me anything, I say. I saved them out and swapped a dozen of them for the sugar and flour. It isn't like the cakes cost me anything, as Mr. Tull himself realizes that the eggs I saved were over and beyond what we had engaged to sell. So it was like we had found the eggs, or they had been given to us. She ought to have taken those cakes when she same as gave you her word, Kate says. The Lord can see into the heart. If it is his will that some folks has different ideas of honesty from other folks, it is not my place to question his decree. I reckon she never had any use for them, I say. They turned out real well, too. The quilt is drawn up to her chin, hot as it is, with only her two hands and her face outside. She is propped on the pillow, with her head raised so she can see out the window. And we can hear him every time he takes up the adze or the saw. If we were deaf, we could almost watch her face and hear him, see him. Her face is wasted away so that the bones draw just under the skin in white lines. Her eyes are like two candles when you watch them gutter down into the sockets of iron candlesticks. But the eternal and the everlasting salvation and grace is not upon her. They turned out real nice, I say, but not like the cakes Addie used to bake. You can see that girl's washing and ironing in the pillow slip, if ironed it ever was. Maybe it will reveal her blindness to her, laying there at the mercy and the ministration of four men and a tomboy girl. There's not a woman in this section could ever bake with Addie Bundren, I say. First thing we know, she'll be up and baking again, and then we won't have any sale for ours at all. Under the quilt, she makes no more of a hump than a rail would, and the only way you can tell she is breathing is by the sound of the mattress shucks. Even the hair at her cheek does not move, even with that girl standing right over her, fanning her with the fan. While we watch, she swaps the fan to the other hand without stopping it. Is she sleeping? Kate whispers. She's just watching Cash yonder, the girl says. We can hear the saw on the board. It sounds like snoring. Eula turns on the trunk and looks out the window. Her necklace looks real nice with her red hat. You wouldn't think it only cost 25 cents. She ought to have taken those cakes, Kate says. I could have used the money real well, but it's not like they cost me anything except the baking. I can tell him that anybody is likely to make a miscue, but it's not all of them that can get out of it without loss, I can tell him. It's not everybody can eat their mistakes, I can tell him. Someone comes through the hall. It is Darrell. He does not look in as he passes the door. Eula watches him as he goes on and passes from sight again toward the back. Her hand rises and touches her beads lightly, and then her hair. When she finds me watching her, her eyes go blank.
Darrell. Pa and Vernon are sitting on the back porch. Pa is tilting snuff from the lid of his snuff box into his lower lip, holding the lip outdrawn between thumb and finger. They look around as I cross the porch and dip the gourd into the water bucket and drink. "Where's Jewel?" Pa says. When I was a boy, I first learned how much better water tastes when it is set a while in a cedar bucket. Warmish cool, with a faint taste like the hot July wind in cedar trees smells. It has to set at least 6 hours and be drunk from a gourd. Water should never be drunk from metal. And at night, it is better still. I used to lie on the pallet in the hall, waiting until I could hear them all asleep, so I could get up and go back to the bucket. It would be black, the shelf black, the still surface of the water a round orifice in nothingness, where before I stirred it awake with the dipper, I could see maybe a star or two in the bucket, and maybe in the dipper a star or two before I drank. After that, I was bigger, older. Then I would wait until they all went to sleep so I could lie with my shirt tail up, hearing them asleep, feeling myself without touching myself, feeling the cool silence blowing upon my parts, and wondering if Cash was yonder in the darkness doing it too. Had been doing it perhaps for the last 2 years before I could have wanted to, or could have. Pa's feet are badly splayed, his toes cramped and bent and warped, with no toenail at all on his little toes, from working so hard in the wet in homemade shoes when he was a boy. Beside his chair is Brogan's sit. They look as though they had been hacked with a blunt axe out of pig iron. Vernon has been to town. I have never seen him go to town in overalls. His wife, they say. She taught school, too, once. I fling the dipper dregs to the ground and wipe my mouth on my sleeve. It is going to rain before morning, maybe before dark. "Down to the barn," I say, "harnessing the team." "Down there fooling with that horse. He will go on through the barn, into the pasture. The horse will not be in sight. He is up there among the pine seedlings, in the cool." Jewel whistles, once and shrill. The horse snorts, then Jewel sees him, glinting for a gaudy instant among the blue shadows. Jewel whistles again. The horse comes dropping down the slope, stiff-legged, his ears cocking and flicking, his mismatched eyes rolling, and fetches up 20 feet away, broadside on, watching Jewel over his shoulder in an attitude kittenish and alert. "Come here, sir," Jewel says. He moves. Moving that quick, his coat bunching, tongues swirling like so many flames. With tossing mane and tail and rolling eye, the horse makes another short, curvetting rush and stops again, feet bunched, watching Jewel. Jewel walks steadily toward him, his hands at his sides. Save for Jewel's legs, they are like two figures carved for a tableau, savage in the sun. When Jewel can almost touch him, the horse stands on his hind legs and slashes down at Jewel. Then Jewel is enclosed by a glittering maze of hooves, as by an illusion of wings. Among them, beneath the upreared chest, he moves with the flashing limberness of a snake. For an instant before the jerk comes onto his arms, he sees his whole body earth-free, horizontal, whipping snake-limber, until he finds the horse's nostrils and touches earth again. Then they are rigid, motionless, terrific. The horse back thrust on stiffened, quivering legs with lowered head. Jewel with dug heels, shutting off the horse's wind with one hand, with the other, patting the horse's neck in short strokes, myriad and caressing, cursing the horse with obscene ferocity. They stand in rigid, terrific hiatus, the horse trembling and groaning. Then Jewel is on the horse's back. He flows upward in a swooping swirl like the lash of a whip, his body in midair shaped to the horse. For another moment, the horse stands spraddled, with lowered head, before it bursts into motion. They descend the hill in a series of spine-jolting jumps, jewel-high, leech-like on the withers, to the fence, where the horse bunches to a scuttering halt again. "Well," Jewel says, "you can quit now if you got a plenty." Inside the barn, Jewel slides running to the ground before the horse stops. The horse enters the stall, Jewel following. Without looking back, the horse kicks at him, slamming a single hoof into the wall with a pistol-like report. Jewel kicks him in the stomach. The horse arches his neck back, crop-toothed. Jewel strikes him across the face with his fist and slides onto the trough and mounts upon it. Clinging to the hay rack, he lowers his head and peers out across the stall tops and through the doorway. The path is empty. From here, he cannot even hear Cash sawing. He reaches up and drags down hay in hurried armsful and crams it into the rack. "Eat," he says. "Get the goddamn stuff out of sight while you got a chance, you pussle-gutted bastard. You sweet son of a bitch," he says.
Jewel. It's because he stays out there, right under the window, hammering and sawing on that goddamn box, where she's got to see him, where every breath she draws is full of his knocking and sawing, where she can see him saying, "See? See what a good one I am making for you? I told him to go somewhere else. I said, 'Good God, do you want to see her in it?' It's like when he was a little boy, and she says if she had some fertilizer, she would try to raise some flowers, and he'd taken the bread pan and brought it back from the barn full of dung. And now them others sitting there like buzzards, waiting, fanning themselves. Because I said if you wouldn't keep on sawing and nailing at it until a man can't sleep even, and her hands laying on the quilt like two of them roots dug up and tried to wash and you couldn't get them clean. I can see the fan in Dewey Dell's arm. I said if you just let her alone, sawing and knocking, and keeping the air always moving so fast on her face that when you're tired you can't breathe it, and that goddamn ad's going one lick less, one lick less, one lick less until everybody that passes in the road will have to stop and see it and say what a fine carpenter he is. If it had just been me when Cash fell off of that church, and if it had just been me when Pa laid sick with that load of wood fell on him, it would not be happening with every bastard in the county coming in to stare at her, because if there is a God, what the hell is he for? It would just be me and her on a high hill, and me rolling the rocks down the hill at their faces, picking them up and throwing them down the hill, faces and teeth and all, by God, until she was quiet and not that goddamn ad's going one lick less. One lick less, and we could be quiet.
Darl. We watch him come round the corner and mount the steps. He does not look at us. "You ready?" he says. "If you're hitched up," I say. I say, "Wait." He stops, looking at Pa. Vernon spits without moving. He spits with decorous and deliberate precision into the pocked dust below the porch. Pa rubs his hands slowly on his knees. He is gazing out beyond the crest of the bluff, out across the land. Jewel watches him a moment. Then he goes on to the pail and drinks again. "I mislike undecision as much as e'er a man," Pa says. "It means $3, I say. The shirt across Pa's hump is faded lighter than the rest of it. There is no sweat stain on his shirt. I have never seen a sweat stain on his shirt. He was sick once from working in the sun when he was 22 years old, and he tells people that if he ever sweats, he will die. I suppose he believes it. But if she don't last until you get back, he says, she will be disappointed. Vernon spits into the dust, but it will rain before morning. She's counted on it, Pa says. She'll want to start right away. I know her. I promised her I'd keep the team here and ready, and she's counting on it. We'll need that $3 then, sure, I say. He gazes out over the land, rubbing his hands on his knees. Since he lost his teeth, his mouth collapses in slow repetition when he dips. The stubble gives his lower face that appearance that old dogs have. You'd better make up your mind soon, so we can get there and get a load on before dark, I say. Ma ain't that sick, Jewel says. Shut up, Darl. That's right, Vernon says. She seems more like herself today than she has in a week. Time you and Jewel get back, she'll be setting up. You ought to know, Jewel says. You've been here often enough looking at her. You or your folks. Vernon looks at him. Jewel's eyes look like pale wood in his high-blooded face. He is a head taller than any of the rest of us. Always was. I told them that's why Ma always whipped him and petted him more. Because he was peekling around the house more. That's why she named him Jewel, I told them. Shut up, Jewel, Pa says, but as though he is not listening much. He gazes out across the land, rubbing his knees. You could borrow the loan of Vernon's team, and we could catch up with you, I say, if she didn't wait for us. Ah, shut your goddamn mouth, Jewel says. She'll want to go and on, Pa says. He rubs his knees. Don't e'er a man mislike it more. It's laying there, watching Cash whittle on that damn, Jewel says. He says it harshly, savagely, but he does not say the word. Like a little boy in the dark to flail his courage and suddenly aghast into silence by his own noise. She wanted that like she wants to go in our own wagon, Pa says. She'll rest easier for knowing it's a good one, and private. She was ever a private woman. You know it well. Then let it be private, Jewel says. But how the hell can you expect it to be? He looks at the back of Pa's head, his eyes like pale wooden eyes. So, Vernon says, she'll hold on till it's finished. She'll hold on till everything's ready. Till her own good time. And with the roads like they are now, it won't take you no time to get her to town. It's fixing up to rain, Pa says. I am a luckless man. I have ever been. He rubs his hands on his knees. It's that darn doctor, liable to come at any time. I couldn't get word to him till so late. If he was to come tomorrow and tell her the time was nigh, she wouldn't wait. I know her. Wagon or no wagon, she wouldn't wait. Then she'd be upset, and I wouldn't upset her for the living world. With that family burying ground in Jefferson and them of her blood waiting for her there, she'll be impatient. I promised my word me and the boys would get her there quick as mules could walk it, so she could rest quiet. He rubs his hands on his knees. No man ever misliked it more. If everybody wasn't burning hell to get her there, Jewel says in that harsh, savage voice, with Cash all day long right under the window, hammering and sawing at that.
It was her wish, Pa says. You got no affection nor gentleness for her. You never had. We would be beholden to no man, he says, me and her. We have never yet been, and she will rest quieter for knowing it, and that it was her own blood sawed out the boards and drove the nails. She was ever one to clean up after herself.
It means $3, I say. Do you want us to go or not? Pa rubs his knees. We'll be back by tomorrow sundown. Well, Pa says. He looks out over the land, awry-haired, mouthing the snuff slowly against his gums. Come on, Jewel says. He goes down the steps. Vernon spits neatly into the dust. By sundown now, Pa says. I would not keep her waiting. Jewel glances back. Then he goes on around the house. I enter the hall, hearing the voices before I reach the door. Tilting a little down the hill, as our house does, a breeze draws through the hall all the time, upslanting. A feather dropped near the front door will rise and brush along the ceiling, slanting backward until it reaches the downturning current at the back door. So with voices. As you enter the hall, they sound as though they were speaking out of the air about your head.
Cora. It was the sweetest thing I ever saw. It was like he knew he would never see her again, that Aunt Bundren was driving him from his mother's deathbed, never to see her in this world again. I always said Darl was different from those others. I always said he was the only one of them that had his mother's nature, had any natural affection. Not that Jewel, the one she labored so to bear and coddled and petted so, and him flinging into tantrums or sulking spells, inventing devilment to devil her until I would have frailed him time and time. Not him to come and tell her goodbye. Not him to miss a chance to make that extra $3 at the price of his mother's goodbye kiss. A Bundren through and through, loving nobody, caring for nothing except how to get something with the least amount of work. Mr. Tull says Darl asked them to wait. He said Darl almost begged them on his knees not to force him to leave her in her condition. But nothing would do but Ants and Jewel must make that $3. Nobody that knows Ants could have expected different. But to think of that boy, that Jewel, selling all those years of self-denial and downright partiality, they couldn't fool me. Mr. Tull says Mrs. Bundren liked Jewel the least of all, but I knew better. I knew she was partial to him, to the same quality in him that let her put up with Aunt Bundren when Mr. Tull said she ought to poison him for $3, denying his dying mother the goodbye kiss. Why, for the last 3 weeks I've been coming over every time I could, coming sometimes when I shouldn't have, neglecting my own family and duty so that somebody would be with her in her last moments and she would not have to face the great unknown without one familiar face to give her courage. Not that I deserve credit for it. I will expect the same for myself. But thank God it will be the faces of my loved kin, my blood and flesh. For in my husband and children, I have been more blessed than most, trials though they have been at times. She lived, a lonely woman, lonely with her pride, trying to make folks believe different, hiding the fact that they just suffered her, because she was not cold in the coffin before they were carting her 40 miles away to bury her. Flouting the will of God to do it. Refusing to let her lie in the same earth with those Bundrens. But she wanted to go, Mr. Tull said. It was her own wish to lie among her own people. Then why didn't she go alive? I said. Not one of them would have stopped her, with even that little one almost old enough now to be selfish and stone-hearted like the rest of them. It was her own wish, Mr. Tull said. I heard Aunt say it was. And you would believe Aunt's, of course, I said. A man like you would. Don't tell me. I'd believe him about something he couldn't expect to make anything off of me by not telling, Mr. Tull said. Don't tell me, I said. A woman's place is with her husband and children, alive or dead. Would you expect me to want to go back to Alabama and leave you and the girls when my time comes, that I left of my own will to cast my lot with yours for better and worse until death and after? Well, folks are different, he said. I should hope so. I have tried to live right in the sight of God and man, for the honor and comfort of my Christian husband and the love and respect of my Christian children, so that when I lay me down in the consciousness of my duty and reward, I will be surrounded by loving faces, carrying the farewell kiss of each of my loved ones into my reward. Not like Addie Bundren, dying alone, hiding her pride and her broken heart, glad to go. Lying there with her head propped up so she could watch Cash building the coffin. Having to watch him so he would not skimp on it, like as not with those men not worrying about anything except if there was time to earn another $3 before the rain come and the river got too high to get across it. Like as not, if they hadn't decided to make that last load, they would have loaded her into the wagon on a quilt and crossed the river first and then stopped and give her time to die what Christian death they would let her. Except Darl. It was the sweetest thing I ever saw. Sometimes I lose faith in human nature for a time. I am assailed by doubt. But always the Lord restores my faith and reveals to me his bounteous love for his creatures. Not Jewel, the one she had always cherished, not him. He was after that $3 extra. It was Darl, the one that folks say is queer, lazy, pottering about the place no better than ants, with Cash a good carpenter and always more building than he can get around to, and Jewel always doing something that made him some money or got him talked about. And that near-naked girl, always standing over Addie with a fan, so that every time a body tried to talk to her and cheer her up, would answer for her right quick, like she was trying to keep anybody from coming near her at all. It was Darl. He come to the door and stood there, looking at his dying mother. He just looked at her, and I felt the bounteous love of the Lord again and his mercy. I saw that with Jewel she had just been pretending, but that it was between her and Darl that the understanding and the true love was. He just looked at her, not even coming in where she could see him and get upset, knowing that Anse was driving him away and he would never see her again. He said nothing, just looking at her. "What do you want, Darl?" Dewey Dell said, not stopping the fan, speaking up quick, keeping even him from her. He didn't answer. He just stood and looked at his dying mother, his heart too full for words. Dewey Dell. The first time, me and Leif picked on down the row. Pa doesn't sweat because he will catch his death from the sickness, so everybody that comes to help us. And Jewel don't care about anything. He is not kin to us in caring, not care-kin. And Cash likes sawing the long, hot, sad yellow days up into planks and nailing them to something. And Pa thinks because neighbors will always treat one another that way, because he has always been too busy letting neighbors do for him to find out. And I did not think that Darl would, that sits at the supper table with his eyes gone further than the food and the lamp, full of the land dug out of his skull, and the holes filled with distance beyond the land. We picked on down the row, the woods getting closer and closer, and the secret shade, picking on into the secret shade with my sack and Leif's sack. Because I said, will I, or won't I, when the sack was half full? Because I said, if the sack is full when we get to the woods, it won't be me. I said if it don't mean for me to do it, the sack will not be full, and I will turn up the next row. But if the sack is full, I cannot help it. It will be that I had to do it all the time, and I cannot help it. And we picked on toward the secret shade, and our eyes would drown together, touching on his hands and my hands, and I didn't say anything. I said, what are you doing? And he said, I am picking into your sack. And so it was full when we came to the end of the row, and I could not help it. And so it was because I could not help it. It was then, and then I saw Darl, and he knew. He said he knew without the words, like he told me that Ma's going to die without words. And I knew he knew, because if he had said he knew with the words, I would not have believed that he had been there and saw us. But he said he did know, and I said, "Are you going to tell Pa? Are you going to kill him?" Without the words, I said it, and he said, "Why, without the words?" And that's why I can talk to him, with knowing, with hating, because he knows. He stands in the door, looking at her. "What do you want, Darl?" I say. "She is going to die," he says. "And old Turkey Buzzard Tull coming to watch her die, but I can fool them." "When is she going to die?" I say. "Before we get back," he says. "Then why are you taking Jewel?" I say. "I want him to help me load," he says.
Tull. Ants keeps on rubbing his knees. His overalls are faded. On one knee, a serge patch cut out of a pair of Sunday pants, wore iron slick. "No man mislikes it more than me," he says. "A fella's got to guess ahead now and then," I say. "But come long and short, it won't be no harm done either way." "She'll want to get started right off," he says. "It's far enough to Jefferson at best." "But the roads is good now," I say. "It's fixin' to rain tonight, too. His folks buries at New Hope, too, not 3 miles away. But it's just like him to marry a woman born a day's hard ride away and have her die on him." He looks out over the land, rubbing his knees. "No man so mislikes it," he says. "They'll get back in plenty of time," I say. "I wouldn't worry none." "It means $3, he says. "Might be it won't be no need for them to rush back no ways," I say. "I hope it." "She's a-goin'," he says. "Her mind is set on it." "It's a hard life on women, for a fact. Some women. I mind my mammy lived to be 70 and more. Worked every day, rain or shine. Never a sick day since her last chap was born, until one day she kind of looked around her, and then she went and taken that lace-trimmed nightgown she had had 45 years and never wore out of the chest, and put it on and laid down on the bed and pulled the covers up and shut her eyes. 'You all will have to look out for Pa the best you can,' she said. 'I'm tired.'" Ants rubs his hands on his knees. "The Lord giveth," he says. "We can hear Cash a-hammerin' and sawin' beyond the corner." "It's true. Never a truer breath was ever breathed." "The Lord giveth," I say. That boy comes up the hill. He is carrying a fish nigh long as he is. He slings it to the ground and grunts, "Ha!" and spits over his shoulder like a man. "Dern nigh long as he is." "What's that?" I say. "A hog? Where'd you get it?" "Down to the bridge," he says. He turns it over, the underside caked over with dust where it is wet, the eye coated over, humped under the dirt. "Are you aiming to leave it laying there?" Aunt says. "I aim to show it to Ma," Vardaman says. He looks toward the door. We can hear the talking coming out on the draft. Cash, too, knocking and hammering at the boards. "There's company in there," he says. "Just my folks," I say. "They'd enjoy to see it, too." He says nothing, watching the door. Then he looks down at the fish laying in the dust. He He turns it over with his foot and prods at the eye bump with his toe, gouging at it. Ants is looking out over the land. Vardaman looks at Ants's face, then at the door. He turns, going toward the corner of the house, when Ants calls him without looking around. "You clean that fish," Ants says. Vardaman stops. "Why can't Dewey Dell clean it?" he says. "You clean that fish," Ants says. "Aw, Pa," Vardaman says. "You clean it," Ants says. He don't look around. Vardaman comes back and picks up the fish. It slides out of his hands, smearing wet dirt onto him, and flops down, dirtying itself again, gap-mouthed, goggle-eyed, hiding into the dust like it was ashamed of being dead, like it was in a hurry to get back hid again. Vardaman cusses it. He cusses it like a grown man standing astraddle of it. Ants don't look around. Vardaman picks it up again. He goes on around the house, toting it in both arms like an armful of wood, it overlapping him on both ends, head and tail. Durn nigh big as he is. Ants's wrists dangle out of his sleeves. "I never see him with a shirt on that looked like it was his in all my life. They all looked like Jewel might have give him his old ones. Not Jewel, though. He's long-armed, even if he is spindling, except for the lack of sweat. You could tell they ain't been nobody else's but Ants's that way without no mistake. His eyes look like pieces of burnt-out cinder fixed in his face, looking out over the land. When the shadow touches the steps, he says, "It's 5 o'clock. Just as I get up, Cora comes to the door and says it's time to get on. Ants reaches for his shoes. "Now, Mr. Bundren," Cora says, "don't you get up now." He puts his shoes on, stomping into them, like he does everything, like he is hoping all the time he really can't do it and can quit trying to. When we go up the hall, we can hear them clumping on the floor like they was iron shoes. He comes toward the door where she is, blinking his eyes, kind of looking ahead of himself before he sees, like he is hoping to find her setting up, in a chair maybe, or maybe sweeping, and looks into the door in that surprised way like he looks in and finds her still in bed every time, and Dewey Dell still a-fanning her with the fan. He stands there, like he don't aim to move again nor nothing else. "Well, I reckon we better get on," Cora says. "I got to feed the chickens." It's fixin' to rain, too. Clouds like that don't lie, and the cotton making every day the Lord sends. That'll be something else for him. Cash is still trimming at the boards. "If there's e'er a thing we can do," Cora says. "Ants'll let us know," I say. Ants don't look at us. He looks around, blinking, in that surprised way, like he had wore himself down being surprised and was even surprised at that. If Cash just works that careful on my barn. I told Ants it likely won't be no need, I say. I so hope it. "Her mind is set on it," he says. "I reckon she's bound to go." "It comes to all of us," Cora says. "Let the Lord comfort you." "About that corn," I say. I tell him again I will help him out if he gets into a tight, with her sick and all. Like most folks around here, I done hope him so much already, I can't quit now. "I aim to get to it today," he says. "Seems like I can't get my mind on nothing." "Maybe she'll hold out till you are laid by," I say. "If God wills it," he says. "Let him comfort you," Cora says. "If Cash just works that careful on my barn." He looks up when we pass. "Don't reckon I'll get to you this week," he says. "'Tain't no rush," I say, "whenever you get around to it." We get into the wagon. Cora sets the cake box on her lap. It's fixin' to rain, sho. "I don't know what he'll do," Cora says. "I just don't know." "Poor aunt," I say. "She kept him at work for 30-odd years. I reckon she is tired. And I reckon she'll be behind him for 30 years more," Kate says. "Or if it ain't her, he'll get another one before cotton picking." "I reckon Cash and Dog can get married now," Eula says. "That poor boy," Cora says. "The poor little tyke." "What about Jewel?" Kate says. "He can too," Eula says. "Hmph," Kate says. "I reckon he will. I reckon so. I reckon there's more gals than one around here that don't want to see Jewel tied down. Well, they needn't to worry." "Why, Kate," Cora says. The wagon begins to rattle. "The poor little tyke," Cora says. It's fixin' to rain this night. Yes, sir. A rattling wagon is mighty dry weather for a bird cell. But that'll be cured. It will for a fact. "She ought to taken them cakes after she said she would," Kate says. Ants. Dirt in that road. And it fixin' to rain, too. I can stand here and same as see it with second sight. A shutting down behind them like a wall. Shutting down betwixt them and my given promise. I do the best I can, much as I can get my mind on anything. But dern them boys. A laying there, right up to my door, where every bad luck that comes and goes is bound to find it. I told Daddy it wa'n't any luck living on a road when it come by here, and she said, for the world like a woman, "Get up and move then." But I told her it wa'n't no luck in it, because the Lord put roads for traveling. Why, he laid them down flat on the earth. When he aims for something to be always a-moving, he makes it long ways, like a road or a horse or a wagon, but when he aims for something to stay put, he makes it up and down ways, like a tree or a man. And so he never aim for folks to live on a road, because which gets there first, I says, the road or the house? Did you ever know him to set a road down by a house, I says? No, you never, I says, because it's always men can't rest till they gets the house set where everybody that passes in a wagon can spit in the doorway, keeping the folks restless and wanting to get up and go somewheres else when he aimed for them to stay put like a tree or a stand of corn. Because if he'd aimed for a man to be always a-moving and going somewheres else, wouldn't he have put him long ways on his belly, like a snake? It stands to reason he would. Putting it where every bad luck prowling can find it and come straight to my door, charging me taxes on top of it. Making me pay for cash having to get them carpenter notions, when if it hadn't been no road come there, he wouldn't have got them. Falling off of churches and lifting no hand in 6 months, and me and Addie slaving and a-slaving, when there's plenty of sawing on this place he could do if he's got to saw. And Darl, too, talking me out of him, dern them. It ain't that I'm afraid of work. I always has fed me and mine and kept a roof above us. It's that they would shorthand me just because he tends to his own business. Just because he's got his eyes full of the land all the time. I says to them, he was all right at first, with his eyes full of the land, because the land laid up and down ways then. It wasn't till that ere road come and switched the land around long ways, and his eyes still full of the land, that they begun to threaten me out of him, trying to shorthand me with the law, making me pay for it. She was well and hale as e'er a woman ever were, except for that road. just laying down, resting herself in her own bed, asking naught of none. "Are you sick, Addie?" I said. "I am not sick," she said. "You lay you down and rest you," I said. "I knowed you are not sick. You're just tired. You lay you down and rest." "I am not sick," she said. "I will get up." "Lay still and rest," I said. "You are just tired. You can get up tomorrow." And she was laying there, well and hale as e'er a woman ever were, except for that road. "I never sent for you," I said. "I take you to witness, I never sent for you." "I know you didn't," Peabody said. "I bound that. Where is she?" "She's a-laying down," I said. "She's just a little tired, but she'll..." "Get out in here, aunts," he said. "Go sit on the porch a while." And now I got to pay for it, me without a tooth in my head, hoping to get ahead enough so I could get my mouth fixed where I could eat God's own victuals as a man should, and her hale and well as e'er a woman in the land until that day. Got to pay for being put to the need of that $3. Got to pay for the way for them boys to have to go away to earn it. And now I can see same as second sight the rain shutting down betwixt us, a-coming up that road like a dern man, like it want e'er other house to rain on in all the living land. I have heard men cuss their luck, and right, for they were sinful men. But I do not say it's a curse on me, because I have done no wrong to be cussed by. I am not religious, I reckon, but peace is in my heart. I know it is. I have done things, but neither better nor worse than them that pretend otherlike, and I know that old master will care for me as for e'er a sparrow that falls. But it seems hard that a man in his need could be so flouted by a road. Vardaman comes around the house, bloody as a hog, to his knees, and that air fish chopped up with the axe like as not, or maybe throwed away for him to lie about the dogs at it. Well, I reckon I ain't no call to expect no more of him than of his man-growed brothers. He comes along, watching the house, quiet, and sits on the steps. "Whew," he says, "I'm pure tired." "Go wash them hands," I say. But couldn't no woman strove harder than Addie to make them right, man and boy. I'll say that for her. "It was full of blood and guts as a hog," he says. "But I just can't seem to get no heart into anything, with this here weather sapping me too." "Pa," he says, "is Ma sick some more?" "Go wash them hands," I say. "But I just can't seem to get no heart into it."
Darl. He has been to town this week. The back of his neck is trimmed close, with a white line between hair and sunburn, like a joint of white bone. He has not once looked back. "Jewel," I say. Back running, tunneled between the two sets of bobbing mule ears, the road vanishes beneath the wagon as though it were a ribbon and the front axle were a spool. "Do you know she's going to die, Jewel?" "It takes two people to make you, and one people to die. That's how the world is going to end." I said to Dewey Dell, "You want her to die so you can get to town. Is that it?" She wouldn't say what we both knew. "The reason you will not say it is, when you say it, even to yourself, you will know it is true. Is that it? But you know it is true now. I can almost tell you the day when you knew it is true. Why won't you say it, even to yourself?" She will not say it. She just keeps on saying, "Are you going to tell Pa?
Are you going to kill him? You cannot believe it is true because you cannot believe that Dewey Dell Bundren, could have such bad luck. Is that it? The sun, an hour above the horizon, is poised like a bloody egg upon a crest of thunderheads. The light has turned copper. In the eye, portentous. In the nose, sulfurous, smelling of lightning. When Peabody comes, they will have to use the rope. He has pustle-gutted himself, eating cold greens. With the rope, they will haul him up the path, balloon-like up the sulfurous air. Jewel, I say, do you know that Addie Bundren is going to die? Addie Bundren is going to die?
Peabody. When Ance finally sent for me of his own accord, I said, he has wore her out at last. And I said a damn good thing, and at first I would not go, because there might be something I could do and I would have to haul her back, by God. I thought maybe they have the same sort of fool ethics in heaven they have in the medical college, and that it was maybe Vernon Tull sending for me again, getting me there in the nick of time, as Vernon always does things, getting the most for Ance's money, like it does for his own. But when it got far enough into the day for me to read weather sign, I knew it couldn't have been anybody but Ance that sent. I knew that nobody but a luckless man could ever need a doctor in the face of a cyclone. And I knew that if it had finally occurred to Ance himself that he needed one, it was already too late. When I reach the spring and get down and hitch the team, the sun has gone down behind a bank of black cloud like a top-heavy mountain range, like a load of cinders dumped over there, and there's no wind. I could hear Cash sawing for a mile before I got there. Ance is standing at the top of the bluff above the path. "Where's the horse?" I say. "Jewel's taken and gone," he says. "Can't nobody else catch it. You'll have to walk up, I reckon." "Me? Walk up? Weighing 225 pounds, I say. "Walk up that darn wall?" He stands there beside a tree. Too bad the Lord made the mistake of giving trees roots and giving the ants Bundrens he makes feet and legs. If he just swapped them, there wouldn't ever be a worry about this country being deforested someday, or any other country. "What do you aim for me to do?" I say. "Stay here and get blowed clean out of the county when that cloud breaks?" Even with the horse, it would take me 15 minutes to ride up across the pasture to the top of the ridge and reach the house. The path looks like a crooked limb blown against the bluff. Ance has not been in town in 12 years. And how his mother ever got up there to bear him, he being his mother's son. "Vardaman's getting the rope," he says. After a while, Vardaman appears with the plow line. He gives the end of it to Ance and comes down the path, uncoiling it. "You hold it tight," I say. "I done already wrote this visit onto my books, so I'm going to charge you just the same, whether I get there or not." "I got it," Ant says. "You can come on up." I'll be damned if I can see why I don't quit. A man 70 years old, weighing 200-and-odd pounds, being hauled up and down a damn mountain on a rope. I reckon it's because I must reach the $50,000 mark of dead accounts on my books before I can quit. "What the hell does your wife mean," I say, "taken sick on top of a dern mountain?" "I'm right sorry," he says. He let the rope go, just dropped it, and he has turned toward the house. There's a little daylight up here still, of the color of sulfur matches. The boards look like strips of sulfur. Cash does not look back. Vernon Tull says he brings each board up to the window for her to see it and says it is all right.